Thank you very much for joining me, even though it's an intimate crowd tonight. So yeah, luckily I only got a few chairs out. So tonight we're going to talk about what I've called Esoteric Island, the magic and symbols of the island. Like everything I do, I don't have all the answers. So a lot of this is kind of speculation and speculative ideas, but there are, you know, it's founded in forms of research that I've done. For those of you that don't know, I am a academically, I'm a historian. Professionally, I'm a artist, writer, and folklorist, and I specialize in stories from the island. So I, you know, although some of it is off the top of my head, a lot of it is founded in actual academic research. But tonight is going to be a little bit more esoteric. So what are we going to be talking about tonight? We're going to talk about what is esoterica. We're going to talk about the symbols. We're going to talk about the magic wand that was found on the island. We're going to talk about engravings that are found all around the island, and then we'll do some interpretations of some of those engravings. So there are sets of engravings that are found around the island that are found in all sorts of places, and they turn up over and over and over again. So that's what we're going to talk a little bit about tonight. So what is esoterica? Esoteric, from the Greek, to mean within the inner circle. So it's obscure knowledge or topics that are only understood or intended to be understood by a small number of people, especially those within a certain group, hence the name within the inner circle. Often refers to works associated with mysticism, occult, and arcane practices. And I really don't like the idea of secret knowledge that people don't know. So I like to share it. And I like other people to share it. I think the more people that know things, the better. I don't believe in gatekeeping. I don't believe in trying to hold bits of information so that other people feel like they have to earn it, because I think knowledge should be free. But I like the name esoterica. So let's talk a little bit about symbols of the island. So there's stuff all over the island, things that are found, things that people do, things that people make, little bits of sculpture on the sand, people, you know, people build them, and things that are found. So this is a ring that was found near God's Hill of St. Mary of Antioch. Okay, so a medieval ring. So there's all sorts of stuff that keeps turning up on the island. Like everywhere, but symbolism is what drives us as a people, as a community. We see it everywhere. The reason that we have churches is to bring the mysterious into our world, to bring a sense of tangibility to the intangible. And that's why we make symbols. That's why we make just, you know, stacking stones. That's why we make beautiful pieces of jewelry. That's why our ancestors would make these things and toss them into rivers as votive offerings. That's why they scraped things on to sandstone and into the chalk. because they're taking something that's intangible and trying to make something tangible of it. That's why if you have a look at the oldest of our churches, you'll see that there's medieval graffiti where people have scratched in all sorts of beasts and things like that, because we as a species need to communicate, and we communicate in all sorts of ways. We want to manifest them in all sorts of ways. So let's go and talk about the Wand of Alvaston. I talked about this a little bit. I've talked about this a little bit a few times. But here's the actual wand, both sides of it. So, just outside of Alvaston, someone wanted to build a fish pond. So we're talking 17, 18 years ago now. Wanted to build a fish pond. So they brought in excavators and heavy equipment and diggers and all that sort of stuff, and they started digging. And they dug up bronze axe head. So immediately they stopped and called in the archaeologists, hoping that what they found was just a one-off thing. But no, it wasn't. And as the archaeologists dug, they found a meeting place. They found a crisscross of causeways. They found roads, ancient roads that all came down to this one spot, this junction of causeways and these ancient timbers. And they found medieval factories. So they found early medieval, they found Roman, they found Bronze Age, they found Iron Age stuff there. This place was important. It has been important since the dawn of people living in this area. And all these timbers and all these causeways and the bronze axe head and all that sort of stuff that they found was beautiful. But they found this. And I spoke to the archaeologists. I sat down and interviewed them, and they said this wand was probably the most exciting thing that they found. It's a piece of hazel. It's about that long, with a point carved in it, and these symbols carved on the edges. And it had been worked, and it had been used, and it had been loved. And at some stage, it ended up being a votive offering or got lost. But it was a magical tool. A magical tool in a magical place. A place of crossroads. Crossroads are very important. Crossroads are where this world and the next meet. Where the creatures of the night walk. Where the people of the day walk. Where the dead meet the living, where witches were buried, where criminals were thrown. And here we have this beautiful, magical object. Now, there are stories on the island of an archmagus, archdruid, a magical priest, a a title that was handed down, and they used, and the story says, and this was well before this was found, it was you, and they always used a hazel wand. I'm not saying this is the wand, but it could be. Who knows? And here we have two really interesting symbols on here. And, you know, looking at them, their real meaning is probably lost to time. I guess we'll never know what they really mean. They could mean anything. And we'll talk about these symbols a little bit more when we get to it. I thought it'd be really interesting just to see the real thing before we get on to the actual.
Where is it now?
It's been taken away and is held by the Museum of London somewhere. And I've spent the last 5 years trying to track it down. And I finally got very close. So I'm hoping within the next year, but 2 years ago, I got very, very close. And then COVID and everything happened. So I'm hoping to be able to get to go see it. The crazy thing is, for a few years, it was sitting in a shoebox under someone's desk, just sitting there. And wasn't cared for or anything like that. So who knows what sort of state it's in now.
Is the wood fossilized?
No. It was preserved in the mud. Yeah. So it's just it's a hazel stick. Yeah. But perfectly preserved. I mean, that thing is older than the Roman occupation. Well, hopefully, eventually you'll find it. So let's have a look at some of the carvings that we see around the island. Now, I'm not going to tell you where these carvings are because they're very fragile. And the more people that go to them and look at them, the more fragile they're becoming. Someone uncovered them recently. They were covered over with a protective layer of sort of hanging moss, and someone ripped all that away. And they've degraded a lot in the last few years. So just before COVID again, someone ripped that away. And I went and had a look at them about 2 weeks ago, and they have degraded substantially.
Sandstone.
Yes, very, very weak sandstone. But this is just a sample of the carvings that are at this place. And there's lots and lots and lots of them. Fortunately, when I originally discovered them, or rediscovered them about 5 or 6 years ago, I documented them all, took a lot of close photographs, and but still not the same as having the real thing. There is wonderful holes that have been bored into the rock as well, where you can see where they've put sticks in and run lines out. And there's all sorts of patterns and things with these beautiful little bored holes in there where they've done all sorts of things. And again, the meaning is lost, absolutely lost to time. But I've taken a selection of them, and we'll discuss them a little bit tonight. But I thought you might like to see the actual originals, or some of the originals. And of course, we have the Cave of Carvings. Everyone know about the Cave of Carvings? Yes. Which is just a sight to behold. Absolutely beautiful. And these symbols show up in there. So it's not like a one-off thing. They show up in there as well in little places all over the place. In between Shanklin and Bond Church. So very difficult to get to these days. But there's all sorts of stuff in there. And we have, you know, more modern magical symbols. You can see over here. We've got faces. We've got all sorts of stuff. What does it all mean? We don't know. Was it that someone used this for smuggling and then they decided to put some scary looking faces to keep people away? Were there carvings there well before someone else rediscovered them and they just continued on? Again, we don't know. But as I said, there are these symbols that turn up there. And these symbols in more modern forms turn up in church, some of the churches around the island as well. So there's a memory, I think, of some of these. So let's move on forward. Let's talk about some of the symbols. So this is the first symbol from the wand. Now I like to think it represents the weird. The waters of divine will, they ebb and flow, flows of life that are set out at your birth. The weird will flow until the eftweird, represented by autumn ladies' tresses. What does all that mean? What is the weird? The weird, loosely translated, means fate, but it's something far more than fate. The weird, where we get the modern word weird. The weird is not set in stone like our concept of fate might be. There are certain pieces and corners in that are set. So think of it more like a river, where when you're sitting right at, when you come to the river, you can see quite clearly what's right in front of you and the ebbs and flows, but the further it gets away, the harder it is to see. And rivers change and flow, so your flow of life will go down, sometimes be fast and sometimes be slow, and depending on which way you go, will change, but you're always going in the same direction, till you end up at the eftweird, the end of all things, or the end of this cycle. I like to think that this sort of represents that. And there's a beautiful, beautiful orchid called Autumn Ladies' Tresses, which you find on the island, which is beautiful and delicate. It's very small. White flowers that goes in a spiral. I like to imagine that maybe that represents the same thing. So we are definitely in speculation territory here. Okay, this is the second symbol from the wand, and I like to think it represents the island. As you can see, it's auto-corrected for me, which is nice of it. The sacred symbol of wit represents the duality of the island, this place and the other, the world of people and the world of magic, the eyes of owls from the world of the living to the underworld. They guide from the world of the living to the underworld. I like to think that, yeah, that's what represents our island, our little magical little island. We're going from east to west. You travel from life to death. And all the while you have the magical eyes of the owls guiding you. So east to west, morning to night, life to death, and you travel through, and they have the duality of this island in sitting in this world, but also, as the old people used to call, the other place, the somewhen, the place that isn't here, the afterlife. But it was a different concept to what you might think of heaven. Because the other place, the somewhen, was exactly what it sounds like. When you came to the somewhen, you didn't know when you were going to come out or where you were going to come out, or if you would come out. And I like to think that's what we're seeing here. And I use that symbol a lot in a lot of the talks that I do, because I just think it's just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So moving on to this guy, this is one of my favorites. And you see him scratched in a few rocks, in some rocks near the Longstone. You see him scratched over near Yarmouth. You see him scratched down near, you did, it's no longer there. Sort of withered away now, down near Blackgang. And in the Cave of Carvings, there he is. I think this represents the horned god. There's always a horned god in the ancient belief systems. The Anglo-Saxons believed in Woden, again, the horned god. God of nature, the great god of fertility, of the wild hunt, is represented by the blackthorn tree. Because if he is the horned god, then it's the blackthorn tree. And blackthorn, they say, can be used to summon the gods. If you take a staff of blackthorn, find the highest peak and ram it into the stones, and you can break the stones with it. You can then call the gods. So I think that's what we're seeing here. I like to imagine anyway. So he's an interesting guy, I think. As I said, we see him all around the place. This guy. He turned up in our little picture up here. Let me show you up here. There he is. I like to call him the aurochs, the great and ancient bull. So the aurochs were the ancient cattle of Europe and a symbol of fertility, abundance, and the banishing of evil shades. And, you know, the bull was always a symbol of virility and strength. You know, you had the cult of Mithras. You had all sorts of, you had the Minotaur, the sacrifice of bulls, the sacrifice of steers, young bulls, very common. So I like to think that guy there is what we're seeing. It just reminds me of the big horns and that long face. Right, so this guy here, what have we got? Irminsul, the great tree of life, the ash tree. The fundamental tree that ties all of the worlds together, the great world tree. So what I think we're seeing here is the tree of life that spans our world, the heavens, the world of the gods, and the world of the dead. I like to think that the branch that sort of goes off to the side there is the, you know, that's the cunning, that's the road less traveled, the other place. And yeah, we see this one, sometimes with the bit off the side, sometimes without. Yeah, so I imagine that this is the great tree of life, which would have been very important and has been for centuries.
Tridents have been quite important in themselves. Yeah,
from the Greek, from the sort of Mediterranean side of things. Yeah. It's certainly not an ancient symbol, no. But yeah, definitely a.
They might have picked it up.
Yeah, they could have picked it up from that. Yeah. Absolutely. Moving right along to this guy here. Call this guy Chu. The arrow, the war god. Most ancient of gods, protector of the land, said to stand at the site of the Weir Tower. What's the Weir Tower? Well, there was a place on the island overlooking, you can see Ventnor and you can see the west and the east, and you can see all that sort of stuff. And up there used to be a tower, a seer's tower, a tower where they go and look and see the world from. The Anglo-Saxons would have called it a weird tower, because that's where they would have seen what was coming, helped them to divine what was to come. And, you know, this could have been Mars. Mars is shown obviously with a circle and an arrowhead. But Chu represented sometimes with a great spear. And so Chu, where we get the name Tuesday. So the god Chu. That's why I call this one Chu. Now, coming to one of my favorites, this one here. Again, we can see this one just here upside down. What are we seeing here? The Mordra, I like to call it. The three mothers or the three sisters, the maiden, the mother, the crone, the three goddesses in one, the Eastern Yah, the Medina, and the Western Yah. That's what I like to think this represents. Three is always a very, very important number. You see it with the Tree of Life, you see it with the Trinity. See, with the three goddesses, the Druid movement is a similar symbol, the neo-pagan movements, neo-Druid movement. Three staffs. Three is always has always been a very important number. So that's what I like to think that we're seeing here. Moving right along. Next one. I struggled over this. I didn't know what this symbol could be, but I've seen it a few times. And I've always seen it sort of either in the western part of a building or facing the west. I thought, well, maybe that's the moon. Maybe that's Morna. I'm not meant to be the mood god, the moon god. My typo there. The protector of the Ilfi children, sister and brother, the spirits of land and air. So the story goes that Muna travels the sky and takes the moon with them. And what we think is the man in the moon now was seen as two spirits, two children, brother and sister. And they actually think that the nursery rhyme Jack and Jill comes from that. And Morna, the moon god, protected those two. So that's what, and I don't have any reason to believe, but I just think it's quite nice.
Are any of these symbols appear runes at all?
No, they're not runic at all. Not at all. No. Now this one is very common seen. It's seen in astrology. It's seen in churches. Seen every, and it means the sun. It always represents the sun, always. So the white fly in the face of convention, right? So we'll call it Suna, the sun goddess. She's chased by the wolf of winter and night. She grows in strength until the winter fellet. Then goes to sleep in Geula. Geula meaning Yule. And comes back to life in the spring. So that is this, the symbols that I wanted to talk about tonight. And again, I think we might actually have her showing up here. There we go. There she is, right there. And I think over here is where you see the symbol that I sort of picked as the moon, just as a, I'm just going off memory at the moment. That's kind of the symbols that I wanted to talk about, and I want to talk a little bit about what these symbols mean and how they work in magic and how they would have been used in magic and what they mean. So magic, I often wondered, where do you draw the line between prayer and magic? Where does that, what's the difference? But there is a fundamental difference between magic and prayer. Prayer, you're asking for something. You're the passive participant. Whereas in magic, you're casting a spell. You're willing something to happen. You're using those fundamental forces to your own will to create, to make something happen. And one of the reasons why magic is opposed by the sort of the Christian, well, the Islamic and Christian faiths, less so Judaism. Judaism is kind of okay with mysticism and magic. In fact, Christianity was fine with magic until the Reformation. It wasn't until sort of after the Counter-Reformation that the Catholic Church kind of balked a little bit at it. In fact, the Catholic Church just thought it was all rubbish, and, you know, the Catholic Church never worried about witches and things like that, because their stance was it wasn't real. There was only one power, and that was through Christ and God. But that hasn't stopped us as as a people, as the faithful, sort of clinging on to the ideas of magic. So magic is, as I said, the willing of something to happen as opposed to leaving it in the hands of a deity or the saints or whomever. And why do we use these symbols? As I alluded to earlier or touched on, it's the making manifest of what we're trying to say and what we're trying to do. We use these symbols to indicate sacred places so that, and this goes back to the whole idea of esoterica, so those that know the language, know the secrets that we're talking about here, will know that these places are sacred, know that these places are filled to the brim with magic, just waiting to share it with you. But only those that are in the know. And the Christians used it too. You know, they early Christians would leave symbols carved into rocks and things so other Christians knew where to go. Yep. But also symbols have power because you are representing something or someone or some magical charm or curse or deity, and you infuse that power into the symbol. And going to you talking about your question about runes in the sort of neo-Nordic traditions, you'll hear people talk about reading the runes, which was not an ancient thing. They didn't do that. They didn't take runes and use them to divine the future. That's a very modern thing, much like our tarot cards. You know, that's a very modern thing, but it is the same principle. You're taking this symbolism and reading something, and you're in touch with the magic and the information that it's trying to tell you. So when you place a mark like that, you're saying something, right? You're saying that this is a place of remembrance, or this is where that goddess may be, or when you take a piece of hazel and you carve it, and then you emboss it, and you put the magical symbols on there. By doing that, by creating, it's a kind of alchemy. You're creating something and you're infusing that inanimate object with the power of that magic.
In the Los Altos Park, there's a place that they call the Witches. And I think it relates to the circle of trees. And that is a big circle of dark trees. And then when you stand in the middle, you'll create some kind of sacredness for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Knowing it's called the Witches, so it has that extra effect.
Well, again, language has power. Why do we say prayers? Why do we chant these things? Why? Let's think about this logically for a second. What's the difference between willing something in your head to come into being, or taking the time to do some rituals to say something out loud? Because words have power. And I'm going to go back and talk about Christianity again. One of the most important things that they say, they talk about God. They talk about God as the Word. Not just the Word of God, but Jesus was the Word made flesh, they say. Because words have power. Why is Tuesday called Tuesday? Because Chew had power. Why is Wednesday called Wednesday? Because it's after Woden. And Woden had power. You know, Thursday, Thunor, the thunder god. Why? Because it has power. So words have meaning, words have power. Words, think of storytelling, the way that they thought of storytelling. Now, we think of storytelling as just little tales that you'll tell. But it wasn't just that. It was magic. It was binding. It was spells. Telling the tale of a great hero was manifesting that great hero. Calling something the witches gives it power. You know, even if it's just to you. Scratching something in a tree gives it power. You go out with your first love and you scratch your heart and you put your initials and their initials. And that's a symbol of that love. And that has power because that lasts forever. Right? So that's what we're talking about here. That's why symbols are so important. Now, we don't know what these symbols really mean. We don't know if someone just got really bored one day and just sort of chipped some stuff on it. I doubt it. Excuse me. It meant something to someone. And we're talking about it 2,000-3,000 years later, right? That person wouldn't know that we'd be still talking about it. Or maybe they did. Maybe they wanted to send us a message. And that's what makes these so fascinating. What makes it so interesting to me is the fact that we don't know and then trying to unravel that. And there is something kind of magical about us investing our own interpretations on these things. I think it's very important.
But it's just throughout history, isn't it? You follow somebody if you wish to be followed, if you wish to follow. But if you've got a little bit of brain in your own head, or you doubt, or you want to investigate further, then you're going to have your own interpretation on that. And that then influences other people.
Well, absolutely. And that's why, even if we forget about the Protestants, let's look at the original Christian churches. And I know I keep going back. It's just a touch pole. It's not I'm trying to convert anyone. There were three main churches that came out of a shakeout of hundreds of different churches, hundreds of different beliefs. You ended up with the Roman church, you ended up with the Coptic church, and you ended up with the Orthodox church, the triumvirate, the three equal churches, but with one main driving force. But you have, each time someone questions something, it splinters a little bit. Changes a little bit here. And the wonderful thing about these stories or these interpretations, even if we did know, even if we were part of that gatekeeping order, each time we tell that story, each time we pass that little bit of information on, it changes slightly. Particularly when we're talking oral traditions, because again, the reason that storytelling was so important to the Celts, to the Anglo-Saxons, was the oral traditions as opposed to the written. Because those words have meaning and those words have life. And every time I tell you something and you take that and you tell someone else, changes a little bit and grows, becomes more interesting and more life comes to it. So when someone sat down and sketched or had their little bit of flint or whatever they did, and they imbued that magic into there, they told a story, And they gave it a name. We can't read that name. You make some assumptions. And they gave it some magic. And there are places all around the island like that. All sorts of places. Places that we all know about. We all know about the Longstone, yes. But there are also places that were considered sacred. There are springs all around the place that were devoted to spirits and gods and saints, all sort of the same thing. That magic, that just imagine and thinking, where's this water coming from? This pure, beautiful water that quenches their thirst. Someone's fallen over and scraped their leg. They find the right, and as they're walking home, they find a spring and they wash their wound and they don't get dysentery. That's magical. It's holy, right? So what do you want to do? You want to tell people about it. So what do? You symbolize it somehow. Let's talk about the witches. Maybe someone saw that this looked like a grove and said, oh, I bet witches hang around here. And they told someone else, and they told someone else, and it became the witches. And just by doing that, imbued some sort of magic to it. Who here has gone out walking? When they've gone out walking, they've found themselves in a grove or the woodland or wherever, and everything's gone quiet. Everything has gone completely quiet. The whisting. They call that the whisting.
People talk about thin places.
Yes. Will-o'-the-wisp. Thin places. The whisting. It goes quiet. And it's like you're transported to another place. And then suddenly, boom, it all changes and then you're back. And the birds are singing and the cars are going. And that spell is broken. And that's the magic, right?
I stopped on the New Forest for the eclipse some years ago, and that was a really spooky experience, and everything stopped. Not only the cars that were going around, but actually it just did feel completely different for those few moments.
Yeah. Mm. And there are places on the island that I've been, and I've just sat, and for what seems like an insurmountable amount of time, it's just quiet, and there's nothing more than my own thoughts. And then all of a sudden, it all changes, and people are around you again, and it's like you're sucked back into reality for that minute, in that minute. Maybe that's where the idea of the Samhain came from. Who knows? I don't think it delegitimizes any of it. So that is kind of the story of symbols. And we'll talk a little bit more about magic, and then because we've got about 10 minutes left. So casting spells. And using runes or using symbols and using things, making offerings, or just using ingredients to make stuff. Why do we do that? Why do we have this driving passion to do this? Why does the devout Catholic go in and light some candles to Mary? Why does the Buddhist light incense in front of statues of their gods. Why do we do that?
That's what we do.
That's what we do. We make things. And think about some of the most magical things that our ancestors would have seen. Imagine a metalsmith coming to your village and taking two metals, putting them in a bowl, heating it up, and out comes bronze. Out comes this other thing. They've taken two things and turned it into something. That's magic, right? That's magic. So if you want to make things happen, you take the things around you, the things that you know, the things that you love. It makes sense. If we love it, the gods are going to love it, or the spirits. You've got to remember that these people just didn't just believe in gods. They believed in spirits. Spirits were just as helpful or not. You know, their relationship with the gods is a very different relationship to what we think of now. We kind of think of a one-to-one relationship with whatever deity, because that's what we've been taught for the last 2,000 years or 1,000 years or so. But gods, sort of pre-Christian gods, weren't kind of like that. They weren't that interested in humanity that much. They were kind of interested in so far as, well, you know, that woman over there is quite good looking. I might go and, or look at those two dopes down there. I might go and, you know, cause a bit of mischief or whatever. But they weren't that interested in humans having a relationship as a one-to-one relationship. So we had to have a way of contacting them, not just through prayer, but also there must have been a sense of, well, we're kind of going this alone. You know, yeah, the gods might show us some favor, but we need to ask the spirits for help. We need to ask the magic. So what do you think their understanding of magic was? What do you think magic war is?
I think it's something you can never know what it is. It's so magical that something that you don't expect to ever understand.
Exactly. So the only way you can make things happen is trial and error. So you draw circles, you use geometry. They may not have known that they were using geometry, but they sure as hell worked out that if they drew that symbol there and they did that, the circle came from the center and you could join it all up and you made a beautiful pattern, right? They knew the basics of those things, and that must have looked magical to them. So they draw these patterns, something good happens. It must have worked. They take some bull's blood and they mix it with some feathers. They take some water from that magical stream that we found, that Aelfric over there told me about, because stopped him getting dysentery. Take some of that water, because that's magic. And we'll mix it all together. See what happens. Something good happened. And then someone takes that and they add in, well, they add in some deadly nightshade. Something bad happens to someone else. And there's your curse. And words have meaning. I curse you. I don't actually curse any of you. But words have meaning. Symbols have meaning. Magic has meaning. And that, my friends, is what this is all about. So we've sort of come to the end. We've got a couple of minutes left. Any questions? Anything anyone wants to discuss?
I was just looking at the symbol on the wall.
Yes.
The left hand.
Yep.
The left hand symbol, part of the symbol, looks more like a bit like a labyrinth.
Yeah, yeah, it does. Absolutely. So here we go. And in fact, I kind of think it is. Because I think this symbol here, I like to think, as I said, you know, it's the duality of the island, this duality of life, right? So one side on the right-hand side, the east you have life and the left you have the afterlife. And the afterlife's not easy, right? It's not, you know, you don't just sort of rock up and there you're done. There's things you need to know. You know, in some beliefs you need to pay the ferryman. In Judaism, you want to ascend through the different heavens. You need to know special symbols, special things, passwords to say to different angels and spirits to ascend. The Anglo-Saxons believed you needed the help of an owl to get yourself into, well, they called it hell or el. But it's not the idea of hell that we have. It's not brimstone and fire. So, yeah, I agree. And that's, you know, I think that's exactly what we're seeing here is some sort of labyrinth. We're here. Life is kind of a bit of a breeze compared to the other place, maybe. I don't know. Any other questions, comments?
Could they not sort of have the idea of, yeah, the you know, if you either up to heaven or down to heaven, that would be those kind of more ancient sort of
yes and no. Some beliefs saw the afterlife as a parallel place. If we look at pre-Christian Anglo-Saxon beliefs, there's virtually no mention of ghosts, not how we'd understand them. You know, someone trapped on earth, because there kind of wasn't there were shades and things like that. So, but you had ancestor worship, and I'm getting to you about the concept of heaven and hell and stuff like that. So that they believed that above was kind of the realm of the gods. And you didn't go there unless you were super, you know, worthy, because then you were kind of hanging out with Woden and or Odin or, you know, whoever you want to call it, getting ready to go fight at the end, at the Eftwird or Ragnarok, as the Nordic would say. The afterlife was kind of down, was underneath the tree of life. So there was this concept of down. We have this concept of heaven and earth and hell being this fiery furnace. That's not really what they believed. No. And the Greeks didn't believe that, and Romans didn't believe that. The afterlife was kind of not really, I guess, not as understood as we'd like them to have understood, I guess, because no one really came back from there. And one of the reasons that you have ancestor worship is to keep your ancestors happy and keep them down there. Right? You don't want to hanging about. And you also hope that when you go, your children and grandchildren will keep you happy while you're down there.
Are you just asleep?
Sorry?
Are you sleeping?
No, I think you're conscious.
Yeah.
I've never been there, so I don't know.
Okay.
Not that I know of. No, I think you're fully, you know, it's, I don't think the concept of you, the idea of you being asleep when you're dead is very much a Christian, very early Christian idea, something that Paul came up with. So the early Christians had a problem. The problem was that Jesus said, I'll be back soon. And Paul, who basically crafted what we think of Christianity, basically said, yeah, that's going to happen, and it's going to happen soon. And everyone, if you die, you're going to rise again, physically rise. They had a problem. Because guess what? Nobody rose. Because guess what? Jesus didn't come. Well, you know, I'm not here to judge. I don't judge anyone's beliefs. But JC didn't turn up. I don't know whether he was late or whether he had, you know, because, you know, if you talk to the Mormons, he was over in North America. He's probably busy over there being racist, according to them. I'm not saying that he was. So, don't know. So they had a problem. So if you're going to physically rise, you need your body, but what's happening while you're kicking around down there? Well, you don't want to be lying in a creepy old coffin, do you? So you're going to be asleep. And that's where the idea of being asleep comes from. That then sort of morphed into the idea of ascending into heaven, because Jesus said, through me, you know, you'll go to heaven. But then they had a problem again. And their problem was, well, if heaven's perfect and you have to be perfect to be in heaven, and nobody's perfect, particularly because a lot of people die without confessing their sins, what are you going to do? So they come up with the idea of purgatory. So people hang around in purgatory for whatever, however long, making up for all their dirty deeds. And then you go to heaven. So it might be purgatory.
Yeah.
Well, maybe. Yeah, that's more hell. So, and the idea of hell as a place of punishment, again, is a not a doctrinal thing. In fact, what they were talking about when they're talking about hell is basically complete destruction of who you are. If you're a sinner, you are thrown into a pit to be burnt and completely obliterated, and that will be the end. But no, they took that to being eternal punishment. So you had the chance to go and hang out with Woden. So you've got to think about how they saw life and death. So, and this goes back to the weird. The day you're born, your date of death is set and it will never change. It might be tomorrow. It might be in the next 5 minutes. It might be in 20 years' time. Who knows? No one knows. But that is set. So the mentality was, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to stay at home, hang about and do nothing and try and keep myself safe? Because that ain't going to work. Because in an hour's time, I may, you know, my number's up. So I can't do anything to stop that happening. It's the one thing that is set. So why not go out and fight in a battle and die on the battlefield in glory and have you plucked out to go to the hall with Woden and join his army and fight and drink and whore and do all that stuff that you can, all that fun, great stuff. Or you can be a coward and just hang out with the shades and the specters and spirits in hell. So to them, it's one or the other. Be the best you can be and have some glory, or don't, and go hang out there. But was there eternal punishment? Not the way that we would understand it. If you were an absolute jerk, if you were a murderer or whatever else, and you hadn't atoned for that, and the way you atoned for that was by paying what was called the Weir Guild. So let's say I took off with your wife. We had a bit of a down the back. I've got my head. But anyway, let's say we did that. You found out and you're like, come on, man. That's a dick move. Come on. What are you doing? Right. You've sullied her. Therefore, you owe me this. So I'd pay you some money. We're square. We're done. All right. And let's say I go down the road and you're baking some bread and I pinch some of your bread and you find out it's me. He's like, come on, look, I would have got 10 pence for those loaves of bread. That's what you owe me. So I'd pay you. We'd be square. We'd be set. But I went out and killed someone in cold blood for no reason at all, just for the pure pleasure of it. Then things would not be so good for me. I'd have to make some sort of atonement for that. But it wouldn't be an eternal damnation. I wouldn't be continually punished forever. No, because there is always some sort of atonement. You know, you have to make some sort of atonement, but if I don't, then things are going to be bad for me. I mean, so the concept of, you know, the afterlife and all that stuff is kind of different to how we look at it now. But I just imagine that probably hell was is in this concept, not, you know, the Judeo-Christian idea of hell, or that the Christian idea of hell, Islamic and Christian, because it's not the same in Judaism. I suspect is, you know, probably quite like now, just long drawn out days. Nothing very exciting happening though. Have to make your own fun. Does that answer your question in a long roundabout way? Anything more?
What's next week?
Next week is Drama Club. Drama Club next week. Then the weekend, then the week after that is a writing workshop. And then the week after that is storytelling. And I think I'm going to tell the story of the stories of the ghost towns, the towns that no longer exist on the island, the ones that are completely obliterated, gone, and the stories around those. Wolverton, Knighton, Fleshland. Who's heard of Fleshland?
As in meat.
No, but sounds the same. Maybe. Maybe not. Have to come and see. Moortown. Story of Moortown. Sorry?
As in
as in Moortown.
That's priced in my head, Moortown.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It used to be its own place.
On the Facebook page.
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. So it's every Wednesday there's something happening.
Going back to the tune.
Yeah.
You said it was above Ventnor. He was quite interested whereabouts. Obviously, it's going to be on down somewhere.
Oh, yes.
Where you can look all over.
So, so you need to, this. It's one of those ones that you need to be very careful about because you need to wait till the tide's right out, and then you can. So when so you can actually just past Ventnor, you can go down. So it's closer to St. Lawrence,
right?
And you can go down when the tide's out. It's actually scratched into some of the into one of the chalk cliffs there. Choose there. Well, the
this is the tower I think he was on about.
Oh, sorry, the Weir Tower.
Weir Tower.
Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah, no.
The arrow, but... you said.
Yes, yes. Well, give me a second and I'll bring it up. Let me just stop what we're up to here. Nope.